are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Late one evening in the summer of 1922, Henry Wilkins burst through the doors of the emergency room covered in his wife's blood. But was he a grieving husband or a ruthless killer who conspired with bandits to have her murdered? To find out, the San Francisco police turned to technology and a new machine that had just been invented in Berkeley by a rookie detective, a visionary police chief, and a teenage magician with a showman's touch. John Larson, Gus Vollmer, and Leonard Keeler hoped the lie detector would make the justice system fairer. But the flawed device soon grew too powerful for them to control. It poisoned their lives, turned fast friends into bitter enemies, and as it conquered America and the world, it transformed our relationship with the truth in ways that are still being felt. As new forms of lie detection gain momentum in the present day, Tremors in the Blood reveals the incredible truth behind the creation of the polygraph through gripping true crime cases featuring explosive gunfights, shocking twists, and high-stakes courtroom drama. Touching on psychology, technology, and the science of the truth, Tremors in the Blood is a vibrant, atmospheric thriller and a warning from history. Beware what you believe. The book that we're featuring this evening is Tremors in the Blood: Murder, Obsession, and the Birth of the Lie Detector, with my special guest journalist and author, Amit Katwala. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Amit Katwala.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this truly extraordinary book.
Thank you.
Now, tell us how you came to be the author of this book.
So this book was sort of born backwards. So I'm a science and technology writer. My background is in psychology, neuroscience. That's what I studied at university. And about 4 years ago now, I was watching Making a Murderer, the true crime documentary on Netflix with yes. Stephen Avery. And in the second season of Making a Murderer, in an attempt to clear his name, Stephen Avery does a test called a brain fingerprinting test, which is a kind of new form of lie detection test that uses brain scans, or says it can use brain scans to tell whether someone's lying. And with my neuroscience hat on, I was kind of thinking, this doesn't make any sense to me. I was, you know, initially quite skeptical of this test. So I ended up doing a lot of reporting into new forms of lie detection, so things like AI, brain scans, other new technologies that people claim can detect lies. But while I was doing that reporting, which ended up being an article for The Guardian and also being part of this book as well, I also found out about the crazy history of the polygraph and the men who created it. And actually what I found was that there were parallels between what happened 100 years ago when the polygraph was invented and what's happening today with these new forms of lie detection. And I guess the purpose of the book, as well as to entertain and inform, is also to maybe strike a warning note. If we don't learn the lessons of the mistakes that were made with the polygraph, then we risk falling into the same trap again with new forms of lie detection in the future.
Now let's start, as you do in the book, you take us to a very incredible scene. May 30th, 1922, Henry Wilkins is with his family. He's a 36-year-old and his wife is Anna. She's 34, and they're with their two children, Henry Jr., an 8-year-old, and Helen, 3 years old. And they were just coming back from a Felton Auto Park in the foothills of the Santa Cruz Mountains, about 70 miles south of San Francisco, where they lived. Take us to that incredible scene and what happens.
Yeah, so they're driving north towards San Francisco, where they live. It's kind of getting dark. There's fog rolling in as they're often is in San Francisco. And Henry notices that there's a car following them. So Henry's car is this bright yellow car. He's a mechanic, so he loves cars. And as he's driving home with his family, he notices this car following them. And the car's been following them for a while. And Henry notices that whenever he speeds up, the car behind him speeds up. Whenever he slows down, the car behind him slows down. And just as they're coming into the city, the car kind of gets really, really close to them. Henry tries to speed up to get away from it, but the car kind of keeps nudging closer and closer and closer. And eventually the car forces Henry to the side of the road, just in the western area of San Francisco. And Henry kind of hits the curbs, the lights go out. And then the next thing he knows, there's a guy standing at the window of the car, pointing a gun at him, asking for money. Henry hands over $300 in cash. But then when the bandit asks for his wife's jewelry, Henry gets annoyed and he starts to reach for his gun, which he's got in the side pocket of his car. And then everything starts to happen very quickly. So what Henry says happens next is that as he's reaching for his gun to scare off the guy who's robbing him, the bandit pulls out his own gun and shoots. And then what Henry says happens is that his wife, Anna, throws herself in front of the bullet, takes the bullet. The guy runs off. Henry's left in the car. His wife's bleeding from a wound in her chest or her stomach. And, you know, he's left not knowing what to do. So then he drives to the nearest hospital, which is just further up 19th Avenue in San Francisco, near the middle of the park, rushes to hospital. They can't do anything for her at that hospital, so they take her to another hospital. Henry follows in his car. By the time he arrives at the other hospital, the doctors tell him that his wife has died. And, you know, he is distraught. I think he collapses. You know, it's a hugely traumatic event for him. So this is the kind of central crime of the first half of the book.
There was a witness, a father and son, Jacob Gorfinkel, who's an attorney. What does he witness related to this attack?
Yeah, so he's kind of driving along and he witnesses two cars kind of speeding past him in close succession. So Henry's yellow car and then this other car following them. And then he sees, and then Henry kind of comes a few minutes later, comes driving along, pulls up alongside him and says, "Help me. I need you to help me get to the hospital. I don't know where the nearest hospital is." So that's how it looks from this witness's perspective, except that, and this is one of the first inconsistencies that begin to creep into Henry's story, that Henry describes the car differently to Gorfinkel, right? So Henry says it's, you know, a particular type of car, and Gorfinkel says it's a different type of car. And this might seem like a minor point, but obviously in those days, the police lead on how to solve this crime was involved looking for a red Dodge, but it wasn't a red Dodge. It was a dark blue Hudson car. So that's one of the first inconsistencies in Henry's story. And then over the following weeks, Henry's story about what happened on the night in question actually begins to unravel.
What was the initial story about how much was stolen and then the denomination of the bill?
Yeah, so Henry said that there were three $100 bills which were taken from him, which was the equivalent of about $5,000 in cash today. And that ends up being important because that's another way that the police try and track down who did this. Because, you know, back then, $100 bills were pretty rare and a lot of people weren't earning. I think the minimum wage was, you know, 25 cents an hour or something like that. So if you're walking around with a $100 bill, then you're either very wealthy or there's something suspicious about it. So then what happens next is, there's this kind of police hunt for these bandits. You know, Henry says there's kind of three men that were involved in this shooting because he saw them as the car was pulling up alongside him and forcing to the side of the road. He said he saw three men kind of in this car. So there's this kind of statewide hunt for these men. And eventually they find these two brothers called Arthur and Walter Castor. And Arthur and Walter Castor are incredible characters, just absolute villains, I guess is the only way you can put it. You know, sort of violent, prone to making terrible decisions. Their father was actually a police officer, a San Francisco police officer who had been murdered. And then after that, the family sort of went off the rails a little bit. And they're kind of in their 20s and 30s. Walter in particular is the, I guess, loose cannon of the family. He, his kind of friends and family would say things like, he makes bad decisions. His friends called him dizzy. He's like impulsive. He's like a child. He's prone to these violent outbursts. And then there's his younger brother, Arthur, who's kind of the more level-headed of the two brothers. And they're actually like, I think, seven Castor boys in all. So huge family. So they get picked up basically at a garage in the Mission, having tried to pay a bill, pay for a repair bill with a $100 bill. And the garage owner thinks this is suspicious. So he calls the police and the police know the Castor brothers very well because they've been in trouble with the police before. So they bring them in for questioning. And then they bring Henry Wilkins in to identify the brothers in a police lineup. But Henry comes in and he says that he doesn't actually recognize either of the brothers as the men who robbed him and shot his wife. So the police have to let the brothers go. So that's the next step. And, you know, Henry is still at this point kind of playing this innocent victim, this bereaved husband, this guy whose wife has been taken from him by this kind of random act of violence.
Police do further investigation into the background and the marriage. And what do they find?
Yeah, so as the police are digging around this case, they find out that, you know, Henry was kind of portraying the marriage as happy, but actually they find out that it wasn't a happy marriage and that a couple of weeks before she died, Anna had actually filed for a divorce. They talk to Anna's friends and family and they find out that Henry was sometimes violent, sometimes he would hit Anna, and that this supposedly happy marriage had actually been unraveling. Anna had been drinking more and more and more. Henry had been allegedly seeing other women. So there was a sense that things were bad in the marriage even before this happened, and that perhaps this patriotic grieving husband that Henry was putting forward was a bit of a front.
The detectives also talk to a garage owner that has something very interesting to say when they ask him if the Castor brothers had ever rented a vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously the car was like a real red herring, because the description that Henry gave led the police completely down the wrong path. They were looking for the wrong car, essentially. But then when they asked this garage owner whether the brothers had ever rented a car, I should say that the other thing that the police did was they showed Henry the Castor brothers' car, and they said, you know, was this the car that you saw at the scene of the crime? And obviously he said no, but because it wasn't. So what happened was that the Castor brothers had rented a car from this garage owner on the morning of Anna's death, and then they had returned it maybe an hour after she was shot. So, you know, that was, and that car, the description of that car matched the car that the witness, Jacob Gorfinkel, had seen speeding down 19th Avenue behind Henry's car. So you see how the police kind of piece it together. So they have this witness who sees a car following Henry's car, and then they have the Castor brothers renting a car that matches the description of that car. That's how, and this car that they found, which they're pretty sure was the car that was following Henry, bears no resemblance to the car that Henry said he saw. So clearly Henry is maybe not telling the full truth about what happened on that night.
Now, Detective Matheson and the Chief O'Brien, Walter is missing. But they look across the bay, you write, to Berkeley. And you write that there is a visionary police chief, a rookie cop, and a teenage magician have been developing a machine with the power to sort truth from fiction. Tell us about August Vollmer and Berkeley and what happens and how these three characters come to be together.
Yeah, so clearly, you know, the San Francisco Police Department were faced with this guy, Henry Wilkins, who they think is lying. And luckily for them, or, you know, unluckily, considering what would go on to happen, some police officers across the bay in Berkeley have just invented the lie detector. So the story of that is Berkeley was sort of a hub for scientific policing. So the chief of police in Berkeley was this guy called August Vollmer, who's kind of considered, he's considered the father of modern policing. He was one of the first people to bring in forensics. He was one of the first people to bring in radios and signaling system for police officers. He, you know, started using fingerprints and photo libraries and things like that to kind of catch criminals. The other thing he did was he started hiring university graduates, college graduates, as police officers. So up until the 1910s, 1920s, most police officers were kind of uneducated, quite brutish people, I suppose, and they used, you know, their fists and their clubs to get information out of suspects. And Vollmer thought that this was a bit distasteful, and he thought that actually hiring college graduates would lead to a more humane form of policing and a better route towards justice.
Right.
He started hiring all these university graduates, and the papers nicknamed them the college cops. And one of Vollmer's college cops was a guy called John Larson. And John Larson was older than some of the other college cops. He was already in his late 20s, but he was different because he had a background in physiology. So he'd done a PhD in physiology, and he wanted to become a criminologist. He wanted to use physiology to help solve crimes. So he went to Berkeley to basically get some real-world policing experience before he then used that in combination with his physiology research to become a criminologist. And Larson was like a terrible cop. He was constantly bumbling, getting in fights with his colleagues, crashing cars, things like that. He was a very good scientist. And in 1922, so the year before Anna Wilkins was shot, Vollmer read a research paper by a guy called William Moulton Marston, who would go on to be the creator of Wonder Woman. But he's also well known for coming up with this essential insight, right? So Marston realized or discovered that when he measured people's blood pressure, as they told false stories, their blood pressure would go up when they were lying. So this is the kind of essential insight that then feeds into the polygraph machine. So Marston noticed that there was a link between blood pressure and people telling lies, essentially, what he thought there was. So Vollmer reads this research paper by Marston, and he thinks, if only we could find a way to formalize that, to make that usable in police investigations, to make it objective rather than subjective. So he calls John Larson into his office one day and he says, John, could you turn this into a machine that we can use to, you know, kind of measure and while we're interrogating suspects? So, you know, John Larson goes away and he cobbles together a bunch of equipment from the lab at the University of Berkeley, like a blood pressure monitor, a sort of a scrolling piece of paper and a pen that kind of scratches away lines depending on whether someone's blood pressure goes up and goes down. And you'll recognize what I'm describing as essentially a polygraph machine, a lie detector. It's not dissimilar to how it looks today. So this is in 1922. And then a few months later, they get a chance to kind of try out this machine on a real case. There's a series of thefts at a women's dorm at the University of Berkeley. And Larson uses the lie detector machine, the cardiopneumopsychograph is what he was calling it back then, which isn't a very catchy name. But he uses that to basically investigate this case of these thefts at this dorm. And then beyond after that, it gets used in a number of other kind of cases. It gets used in the murder trial, a case of a guy called William Hightower, who's accused of murdering a priest. And it gets more and more popular over the following year. So by the time the Wilkins case comes around, the lie detector is sort of getting wider recognition in the press, and you know, it's generally thought of in kind of positive terms. So those are the two kind of creators, I guess, of the lie detector. The other person who's important in this story is a guy called Leonard Keeler. So Keeler was about 16 at the time that Larson was inventing the lie detector. She was a high school student, quite a sickly boy. He'd been off school for a while with various illnesses. And he was a family friend of August Vollmer's. So Vollmer was friendly with Charles Keeler, who was Leonard Keeler's father. He knew that Keeler was sort of, you know, kicking his heels at home. So one day he said, oh, why don't you come into the police department and, you know, I'll show you around. So, you know, Keeler comes into the police department one day, just the kids, you know, he's quite a, you know, interesting guy. He's into like animals. He keeps rattlesnakes at home. He likes does slotted hand magic and things like that. But anyway, the moment Keeler sees Larson with the polygraph machine, he's like completely fascinated by this machine. And he becomes Larson's kind of protege. He comes as assistant. He helps Larson take the machine all around California doing tests on people and things like that. So those are the three main characters. And, you know, so this is in kind of the spring of 1922. So by the time the Wilkins case rolls around a year later, these three characters have kind of honed the lie detector and they think they're onto a good thing. It's been used in a couple of murder cases and lots of like thefts and things like that. And the Wilkins case is like another kind of big step for them.
What about the actual polygraph examination? Who conducts it? As we know it, there are control questions. Like today, we know it, that there are some kind of control questions. How did they conduct this? How long did it take? You describe in the book what happened and the results that they announced, and then also their, I would say, hesitancy later.
Yeah, that's right. So lie detector tests are not the same as they are shown on TV or in movies often. They take a lot longer. They're a lot more boring. The protocol that Larson kind of instigated was that you would ask a series of yes or no questions, starting with control questions like, is your name Henry? And then moving on to target questions like, you know, did you shoot your wife? And the test as it was designed required you to wait a minute between each question to allow someone's body to react to the question and then allow it to come back to a baseline before you then ask the next question. And the theory is that by comparing the responses to the control questions to the responses to the kind of target questions, you can determine whether someone's lying. Because if they're lying, the theory is that their pulse and their blood pressure will go up. If they're telling the truth, the theory is that it won't. That's one of the points I try and make in the book is that, you know, I don't think we can necessarily take that for granted, which means that the polygraph is slightly flawed. But yeah, so John Larson kind of gets the ferry across the bay to San Francisco, and he does this lie detector test on Henry Wilkins. And, you know, at this time, the Castor brothers are sort of in the wind, right? They've been released and they've basically just disappeared from the city. And Henry is being seen with much more suspicion by the press and by the police. But actually, he takes the lie detector test and he passes the lie detector test. So according to this machine that's been invented, Henry is innocent. He's had nothing to do with his wife's death and he's just been sort of wrongly implicated. He is the victim of kind of random violence. And so again, the police are kind of forced to just let him go. So Henry is brought in to do the lie detector test. He passes the lie detector test and then he's let go. So then the police are kind of back to square one, right? Their initial suspects, the Castor brothers, were released because Henry said he didn't recognize them. And then Henry was brought back in when they realized that actually he did know the Castor brothers. So that's the other thing, the important thing that happened. So it had transpired in the intervening weeks that Henry had actually worked with Walter Castor and then was acquainted with the people that the police think shot his wife, which is, again, is like a real red flag. But they bring him in and he passes the lie detector test. So they let him go.
Larson, even at this time, you write, is not in agreement with the things that Keeler bring into the equation. What are some of the things that they disagree with?
Yeah, so I guess the way you can characterize this is that Larson is sort of the kind of rational, scientific, careful, cautious part of this. So he invents the machine, but he sees it as a scientific instrument, realizes that it needs to be validated and that a lot of research work still needs to be done before it should be rolled out beyond the very few select cases that he is personally involved in. Keeler was, in the book I describe him as kind of a showman. He's much more interested in using this machine to solve crimes, you know, chase down criminals, crack cases, do all these kind of dramatic, heroic things. And sometimes, because Keeler's not a scientist, he sort of discards the careful, cautious scientific method that Larson would prefer that he use. So this is the essential kind of difference between these two men. And in the years that follow, these two men have spectacular fallings out over their different attitudes to the polygraph machine. And actually, John Larson really ends up hating Keeler by the end of the book. You know, he really, really kind of despises him. He thinks that Keeler has turned this machine that he invented, that Larson invented, into sort of a Frankenstein's monster, right? Keeler is largely responsible for the spread of the polygraph around the world, but Larson kind of never really forgives him for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to this incredible scene that you have with this further investigation into Henry Wilkins by the district attorney Brady. And Brady has this very, very creative plan to sort of disrupt Arthur and elicit a confession. Tell us about this incredible scene.
Yes, this is a fascinating, fascinating thing that I discovered. So basically, eventually they managed to find Arthur Custer and arrest him. This is and kind of bringing him back to San Francisco, and that he still kind of says, "Oh, I've got nothing to do with this Anna Wilkins shooting. You know, I'm innocent, etc., etc., etc." But he's sitting in a jail cell, and they're trying to come up with ways to get him to talk. So Arthur Custer, this is like mid-June 2023 by this point, and Arthur Custer is kind of sitting in this jail cell at this point, and he hears a young kid, kind of like a teenager, I guess, being brought in. And he talks to him briefly, and the kid says, "You know, I'm being sent down for the Anna Wilkins murder, and I didn't do it. I'm innocent. And Arthur's like, "Okay." And then what happens is that night they put this kid in the cell next to Arthur, and all night he can hear this kid moaning and crying and wailing. You know, they're gonna hang me. You know, I'm innocent. I didn't do it, etc., etc., etc. And this goes on for a couple of nights, and then eventually Arthur's conscience starts to weigh on him. You know, his mother comes in, and his mother tells him, "Oh, you know, you should do what's right." And so, you know, a couple of days later, Arthur confesses. He says, "You know, we were involved in the shooting, and it was Henry Wilkins that paid us to kill his wife." And this is kind of a bombshell moment in the whole case. And actually, it happened, because the kid that they brought in to cry and wail and moan in the cell next to Arthur's cell was an actor. He was not actually a real suspect at all. They brought him in with the express purpose of kind of tricking Arthur into confessing. And it worked. And it also pointed the finger straight back at Henry Wilkins, which means two things, really. It means that the police had released not only Walter and Arthur Custer, who ended up being implicated, but they'd also released Henry on the basis of a test on the so-called lie detector machine. And the reason that I kind of picked this case for this book about the history of the polygraph machine is that it was one of the first kind of high profile failures of this machine, the first of many, I should say.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Are you aware that on average today it's taking up to 11 weeks to be able to hire employees for open positions? If you're hiring for a growing business, you don't have up to 11 weeks to wait. Well, if you're listening today, I've got some advice for you. Stop waiting and start using ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter can help you find qualified candidates for all your roles fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology quickly finds and then informs you about the most qualified candidates available. Then you simply invite them to apply. With ZipRecruiter, 4 out of 5 employers get a serious candidate within the first day. So speed up your hiring process with ZipRecruiter. See why 3.8 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we talked about this dramatic failure, at least that John Larson felt it was a dramatic failure of this device that he had put a considerable part of his life into. But how did August Vollmer react, and how did Keeler respond, and what was the next chapter in the lie detector?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So they were kind of still pretty positive about the machine. Keeler in particular was kind of not that fussed about the Wilkins case, and felt that they shouldn't stop rolling out the machine, right? So by this point, you know, they're kind of plowing ahead with more and more cases. Larson is getting increasingly worried, I guess, or reluctant to use the lie detector until it's been proven to work, but Keeler is kind of charging ahead. By this point, Vollmer and Keeler are both in LA, where they're kind of working together, using the lie detector on various cases. And so it doesn't really change the momentum of things, I suppose.
We didn't mention, too, this incredible trial that looks like a slam dunk. What happens at that trial and retrial?
Yeah, so the trial is kind of long and twisting, and it's got some incredible characters in it. Frank Murphy, who's Henry Wilkins' attorney, is this kind of bullish, kind of belligerent kind of guy, and there's lots of kind of drama, twists and turns, and drama and all sorts of stuff going on in the trial. One of the major revelations to come out of the trial is that Henry has been having an affair with his wife's sister. So that's one of the kind of main things that comes out during the kind of trial and the pre-trial. And as it transpires, Anna's sister came over from Germany a few months before Anna died, and basically was and struck up an affair with Henry Wilkins, essentially. So yeah, more and more kind of fingers seem to be pointing at Henry. But the first trial, it's kind of a hung jury, so they don't come to an agreement in the first trial. And basically what happens is that the prosecution calls, you know, Arthur Castor and Walter Castor, who then, you know, obviously go out and say that they were paid by Henry to shoot Anna, but no one really believes them. The jury kind of think, okay, well, on the one hand, you've got this grieving husband who, yes, maybe was having an affair, but on the other hand, you've got these two renowned crooks with long criminal records. And actually, what ends up happening is that they don't really believe anyone in the case, right? They don't believe either Henry or the Castor brothers. But so there's no kind of unanimous verdict, and actually it goes to a retrial. And the retrial follows a very similar pattern, you know, same kind of witnesses, same kind of attempts to malign the characters of various people, same, you know, kind of underhand tactics used by the attorneys. At one point, the attorneys kind of almost come to blows. So the opposing attorneys are literally standing outside the courthouse, squaring up against each other, and they have to be separated by the police. But at the end of that second trial, Henry is found innocent. So actually no one goes to jail for this crime. And the other thing we should talk about, of course, is the shootout.
Yes.
So they managed to catch Arthur Castor kind of relatively early on, but Walter Castor still kind of disappears. So after the Castor brothers were initially released, they kind of flee north. So they get a car and they drive up the West Coast towards Eureka, up through the kind of old gold mining country and the Redwoods. And eventually they pitch up, you know, somewhere on up there, and Arthur's brought back to San Francisco, but Walter is still kind of on the lam. But at some point, Walter sneaks back to San Francisco, and the police are watching him, and then they get a tip about where he is one day. So they send kind of three police officers down to go and get him when he's staying at his mother's house, and they send three police officers to go and kind of arrest him and bring him back so that he can be tried in this Henry Wilkins case. And essentially what happens is that as the police knock on the door and they enter, so Walter's mother answers the door, the police barge in, and then the shooting starts. Walter shoots one of the police officers in the head, in the just above the eye. He shoots another one in the chest. He shoots his girlfriend, who he suspects of having led the police to him. And then he turns the gun on himself. And in the space of about 2 minutes, there is massive bloodshed at this house, San Francisco. One of the police officers dies. The other one is okay eventually, but has to have eye surgery. And then obviously Walter's girlfriend and Walter both pass away as well. And for John Larson, this is like a really like tragic turn of events, because he's kind of thinking, oh, if my machine had worked properly, this would never have happened, right? Or if the machine had not existed, maybe Henry would have been arrested and, you know, they wouldn't have had to track Walter down in this way. So in his mind, it's like the machine failed. And because the machine failed, all these people are now dead. So it's a really dramatic kind of turn of events.
Tell us about the landmark case that set a precedent involving an Alfonso Fry.
Yeah, so this is the Fry case. So I mentioned William Marston at the top as the guy who kind of came up with this concept of lie detectors and blood pressure being linked. And Marston was really keen for the lie detector to be accepted in court. And he tried to use this test case of this guy called James Alfonso Fry. He was a First World War vet, a 25-year-old who had been accused of murdering a prominent black doctor in Washington. And Marston wanted to use this case as a kind of test case for getting lie detection accepted in court. But the judge was not convinced. He basically said something like, when this technology is broadly accepted by experts in the field, then it will be sufficiently developed to be usable in a court of law, but it hasn't reached that case yet. And this standard of qualification, which was known as the Frye standard, kind of became the de facto benchmark which new technologies have to reach in order to be usable in court, you know, whether that's fingerprinting, blood spatter analysis, all these kind of new technologies that people want to use as evidence have to meet the standard where they're kind of broadly accepted by experts in the field. And the polygraph didn't reach that standard. And actually, the polygraph has never reached that standard, which is why it's not usable in court, in federal court in the US.
Tell us about Max Dent and how he figures into this story.
Yeah, so about halfway through the book, we jump forward in time. So after the conclusion of the Henry Wilkins case, Henry is released. He, you know, carries on with life. He moves away from San Francisco, where his name is sort of mud, essentially. And the lie detector continues to... Oh, well, one thing I should say before we go on to Max Dent is that John Larson is kind of desperate to find Henry guilty, to prove that he was guilty. So after Henry gets released, John Larson kind of befriends Henry Wilkins and yes, basically convinces him to take another lie detector test, which Henry passes again. And then he also convinces him to do a truth serum, which again, Henry kind of passes. It still shows up that he's telling the truth. John Larson remains convinced that Henry's innocent, but with no evidence, he sort of has to let it go. But he never really stops thinking about that case. But anyway, so yes, after the conclusion of the Henry Wilkins case, Larson becomes increasingly sort of reluctant to spread the polygraph any further until he's done the kind of scientific validation work. Leonard Keeler becomes more and more hardworking in his efforts to sell it, to market it, to commercialize it, to spread it to the world. So 12 years later, this is 1935 now, so they have all relocated independently to Chicago. So Vollmer is in Chicago teaching courses at a college. Larson has been bouncing around various jobs. One of the problems with John Larson is that he's incredibly stubborn and sort of very, belligerent and can't keep a job because he constantly gets in fights with his superiors over trivial matters. So, you know, by this point, it's 1935, and then Leonard Keeler's in Chicago as well. He's working at a crime lab, kind of doing all this cool stuff like, you know, ballistics and tracking down gangsters. It's the Capone era. So Chicago is the kind of capital of crime in the US. So Keeler's there sort of, you know, using his skills to kind of catch criminals. So yeah, 1935, and a guy called Max Dent has popped out to buy cigarettes in the west side of Chicago. He's Jewish. It's a very Jewish area. They're kind of immigrants from Eastern Europe. He lives with his parents. He's popped out to buy cigarettes, and he's walking back from the shop back to home when someone runs out of an alleyway and basically guns him down. And the suspect is kind of quickly identified as a guy called Joe Rappaport. And the theory is that basically Max Dent is a prolific police informant. He has been snitching on people all over Chicago, and he essentially like deals drugs and then like tells the police that he sold so-and-so drugs. So they then go and arrest that person. And the theory is that Joe Rappaport is one of the few people Max Dent has informed on who's not already in prison. And therefore, he's one of the few people with both the means and the motive to have shot him. So Rappaport is kind of quickly arrested, and he becomes the sort of next kind of big, this becomes the next big case that I look at in the book, because the lie detector becomes entwined in this case later on in proceedings.
Tell us about the case while Keeler is in Joliet Prison that adds so much controversy to the lie detector.
Larson's in Joliet Prison. Yeah, so it's a really famous case. It's the Leopold and Loeb case, which you might have heard of before. This is two young men in the kind of 1920s, I think, or 1910s maybe, who basically kidnap and murder this kid because they want to prove they can get away with the perfect crime. And at this point, it's kind of 1936, and Richard Loeb is at Joliet Penitentiary, where John Larson is working as kind of the prison sort of psychiatrist. And Larson comes out of his office one day, and he finds Loeb completely naked, dripping wet, and covered in blood. He's had his throat slashed, basically. And Larson had like struck up quite a close relationship with Loeb in the previous months. And essentially what happens is that Larson is told not to speak to the press about what's happened. The kind of people that run the prison don't want this case getting out into the papers, but Larson refuses to adhere to those rules. So this murder of Richard Loeb by another prisoner ends up costing Larson his job at Joliet. It's a interesting kind of side story here that kind of ties Larson into the political machinery at the time, which is kind of fascinating.
You also write about a case that really helps the lie detector. There is a movie at one time called The the Canary murder case, but this is the real Canary murder case, it was dubbed. Tell us about this murder case involving the Canary.
Yeah, so this is kind of fascinating. This is one of the cases where, and it all kind of comes together at the end, but this is one of the cases that really popularized the lie detector in Chicago and led to it being used in the Rappaport case. So basically, there was a judge in Chicago called Henry Horner who was investigating police corruption. And there was a case of a woman who had died and the police were guarding her house. And one of her, she ran a cafe called, I think, the Singing Bird Cafe. And one of the kind of star attractions of the cafe was this yellow canary. He would sing and people loved it. Anyway, the police were guarding this house and the canary disappeared. And there'd been a spate of kind of thefts from crime scenes. And it was a very corrupt era in policing. So immediately Horner was like, okay, well, I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to get to the bottom of who has stolen this canary. And they basically brought in Len Kilo and August Vollmer to do lie detector tests on all the police officers involved. And they were able to get a confession from one of the officers that he had stolen the canary and then swapped it out for another one, essentially. And so the lie detector successfully solved this case, and that stuck with Horner. And basically what happens is Horner then goes on to become the governor of Illinois eventually. So this judge who is really close to Len Keeler, he strikes up a really close friendship with Len Keeler, actually ends up administering Keeler's wedding, ends up becoming the governor of Illinois. But by the time the Jay Rappaport case is kind of going through the courts, Horner is now the governor of Illinois. And that ends up being important because Jay Rappaport, for shooting Max Dent, has been given the death penalty.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talk about Joseph Rappaport and his troubles, but he has a sister named Rose. Tell us about his legal troubles and Judge Horner, or the former Judge Horner, and Rose.
Yeah, so that's right. So Rappaport is on death row in Chicago and at the Cook County Penitentiary. And his sister is distraught. And she, as she did the previous time Rappaport got arrested, she writes hundreds of letters to anyone she can to try and get the sentence commuted, get it overturned. So she bombards Henry Horner, the governor of Illinois, with, you know, pleas for clemency. She doorstops him at the station. She, you know, threatens to curse him and, you know, all this stuff when if he doesn't, you know, let her brother live, essentially. And what happens is that Jay Rappaport's death sentence keeps getting commuted. So it keeps getting delayed. Not commuted, sorry, keeps getting delayed. And I think it happens like three or four times. He's, you know, due to go to the electric chair and something happens at the last minute, some legal route, and actually it gets pushed back. You know, it gets delayed for legal reasons. It gets delayed for Jewish holidays. And eventually, Rose Rappaport manages to convince Henry Horner to cancel the execution for good if Jay Rappaport can pass a lie detector test. And that's where Len Keeler comes in. So Horner obviously knows Keeler, and that's why he knows about the lie detector test. So he calls Keeler up and he says, you know, can you go and do this lie detector test on this death row inmate? And that's what kind of forms the kind of closing segment to the book, is this really dramatic lie detector test in the prison on the guy who's due to be executed that night.
It's fascinating too, you write though, that the precedent had already been set that it couldn't be used in court. But what was the sort of loophole that they saw it as?
Yeah, it was sort of a last roll of the dice. Like, I guess in a similar way to Stephen Avery using a brain fingerprinting test to try and clear his name, Joe Rappaport was desperate enough to try anything. But the problem is that, like, a death row cell is not an appropriate place to conduct this kind of test, right? You know, you can't, how can you be, if you know that you're going to be executed, if this test, you know, goes the wrong way for you, what would your blood pressure be like? You know, how can that be a fair test? You know, the lights in the cell were literally flickering because they were testing the electric chair in the next room while Jay Rappaport was doing this test. So it's a kind of classic example of this supposedly scientific test being used in a way that was not scientific at all, and that John Marston would have been appalled by and was appalled by when he found out it happened. So essentially, Rappaport fails the lie detector test that's conducted by Keeler and is marched from his cell to the electric chair. And is executed and becomes the kind of first person to be executed as a result of failing a lie detector test.
You write about the relationship. We have talked about it a little bit, but more so what Larson does in the relationship with Keeler and the relationship between Keeler and Larson and Vollmer. Tell us about the relationship between all three of these creators of this supposed lie detector?
Yeah, essentially over the course of, you know, from about 1925 onwards and accelerated by things like the Max Dent and Joe Rappaport case, it begins to disintegrate. By, you know, by the early 30s, Keeler and Larson are no longer on speaking terms. Like, Larson writes these kind of bitter, like vitriolic letters to Vollmer complaining about Keeler and supposed slights. Keeler writes back to Vollmer kind of complaining about Larson, and Larson badmouths Keeler all around town, and Keeler complains about, you know, Larson badmouthing him and all this kind of stuff. And eventually what happens is that both Vollmer and Keeler cut ties with Larson. You know, Vollmer kind of decides that actually it's not worth the grief of trying to continue to maintain a relationship with John Larson. So John Larson ends up sort of bitter and alone, kind of collecting newspaper clippings of lie detector stories, you know, scanning the press for bad news stories about Keeler that will reflect badly on Keeler, his former protege. And yeah, their relationship sort of disintegrates. And then Keeler has quite a sad story as well. So Keeler's wife leaves him. He kind of descends into alcoholism. He basically does nothing but drink. His business fails. He set up a business kind of selling lie detector tests that fails. And he dies really, really young of liver disease because of the amount that he was drinking.
You write about that the lie detector lives on. And you talk about work in the United Kingdom using the machine. Tell us about where it does still continue in its use. And then tell us about, again, Larson's conclusions after all of these years being involved in lie detection.
Yeah, so it's still used very widely today. So there's about 3 million tests a year in the United States. It's being used in the UK more and more rather than less and less, which is sort of slightly alarming. So it's being used to do screening tests on suspected terrorists and like decide whether people are eligible for parole. So it's used quite broadly. And then the other thing that's happening is that new forms of lie detection are being invented that kind of still have the same flaws as the polygraph. So yeah, by the end of his life, John Larson was pretty despondent. And he kind of writes something like, you know, this machine that he thought would fix the criminal justice system, you know, be a force for good, actually ended up being a Frankenstein's monster. He regrets ever having invented it. And the person he blames for that is Leonard Keeler.
August Vollmer, you write initially, his ascent into legendary status as this modern, a person that was the fixture of modern policing, but he has his own problems with his reputation and credibility as time goes on, doesn't he?
Yeah, so I think during his life, Vollmer was kind of very well respected, and he dies, actually, he takes his own life because of the kind of pain of living with various ailments that begin to afflict him as he gets older. He shoots himself in his garden. And I think during his life, he was kind of considered this like revolutionary father of modern policing. I think it's only in the last maybe 10, 15 years we begin to reassess that perspective. I think in light of some of the issues around policing at the moment, this kind of very, like, I guess the technification of policing has maybe had some bad impacts that probably can be traced back to Vollmer. So I think his heart was in the right place. You know, he wanted to make policing more humane. But I think in bringing in certain technologies that ended up not being good things to use, he maybe sowed the seeds for some of the problems that we see today, the over-militarization of police and things like that.
You write that the National Registry of Exonerations lists more than 200 people wrongfully imprisoned after failed polygraph tests. And you say those are just the ones whose convictions were overturned. The real numbers are potentially much higher.
Yeah, this is the underlying point of the book, right? That the lie detector tests don't work, right? And the fascinating thing is that we still use them, and they're still kind of seen as a technology that should be used to try and catch criminals. And look, undoubtedly, these machines have helped to put guilty people behind bars. But the problem is that they've also perpetrated kind of horrendous miscarriages of justice. And I guess the lesson from the two main cases that I face on the book, the Henry Wilkins case and the Joe Rappaport case, is that these machines are not infallible. You know, it's my view that in the Henry Wilkins case, the lie detector test got it wrong, right? It wrongly said Henry was innocent of plotting to kill his wife when he was probably guilty. As a result of the lie detector test getting it wrong, several more people died who didn't need to die. And then the Joe Rappaport case, I think Joe Rappaport probably was guilty, but the decision about whether to execute someone should never have been made by a flawed machine.
Yes.
And there's all sorts of research over many decades basically proving that the polygraph is not accurate. Estimates of its accuracy range from, you know, as high as 90% to as low as 65%.
Yeah.
65% is really low. And the problem is that we're often using these technologies in edge cases. You know, they're really difficult to determine things. And the stakes are so high that I don't think it's appropriate to be using these technologies to decide whether someone lives or dies or whether someone spends the rest of their life in prison.
I think the dramatic example that you provide about Gary Ridgway being questioned and then polygraphed, and then passing, and then went on to kill at least seven more women. The idea that someone could beat this machine is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's trivially easy to be. You can train to be in the machine fairly simply by basically learning how to alter your responses to the control questions so that when the real questions come around, there's no difference, right? If you can artificially speed up your blood pressure or your pulse when you're asked a control question and when you're asked a target question, that, you know, there'll be no difference. So, you know, all these forms of lie detection are sort of slightly flawed in different ways, and that makes them problematic.
I think the most dangerous part is to use the lie detector to clear people of guilt. And reading so many books about investigations where they utilize the polygraph, it's fascinating to realize that how many potential serial killers or killers that slip through their fingers because they relied solely on that lie detector test.
That's it. And I think even the problem is if it's framed as one tool and a tool of in a suite of many different tools, and it's given an appropriate weighting, then maybe it's okay to use it. But I think the problem is when you call something a lie detector test, you give it more weight than it warrants. And actually, who knows, if they hadn't done a lie detector test on Gary Ridgway, maybe they would have found more evidence or done more digging, or, you know, been more suspicious for longer, and maybe they would have kept him in jail. And you don't know what that case would have looked like if the polygraph test hadn't been used, right? And what, how it would have progressed. So that's really problematic, I think.
John Larson had planned to write his magnum opus, you say, but he died sorting through his manuscript pages. But you say that today a new wave of lie detection technologies are coming to market, powered by brain scans and artificial intelligence. Tell us some of the things that are being adopted by police and other institutions and agencies.
Yeah, so there's been a long history of this sort of stuff. So it started in the kind of 70s. There was things like voice stress analysis, which kind of tries to tell if someone's lying based on their tone of voice. Then through the 80s and 90s, there was brain fingerprinting, which I talked about, that uses brain scans. So you wear kind of a cap on your head with electrodes that measures your brain waves. There's also fMRI-based brain scanning. So you sit in an MRI scanner while you look at these questions, and supposedly that can tell if you're lying as well. And then more recently, there's kind of AI-powered lie detection technology. So I went to do a test by a company called Converis, which looks at your pupil dilation as you answer a series of questions and determines that, tries to use that to determine whether you're lying or not. So the theory is that if you are thinking harder, then your pupils are more dilated. So that's true. The theory is that if you're lying, you're thinking harder, therefore your pupils are more dilated, and that could be a way to catch liars. So yeah, there's a whole suite of technologies. Often the investment in new lie detection technologies sort of goes hand in hand with the political climate of the time. So when governments are trying to look tough on security and crime, then they'll fund things like new forms of lie detection. So there was a big spike in new forms of lie detection after 9/11, for instance. And yeah, so that's where we're at. And, you know, these forms of lie detection are being adopted, even though they're not 100% accurate, and they have some of the same flaws as the polygraph. And the biggest problem with the polygraph is what researchers call the fact that there's no Pinocchio's nose, right? There's no telltale sign of lying that's true for everyone all of the time. And without that, you know, these machines, you can't know if someone's pulse is going up because they're lying or because they're nervous about being wrongly accused of lying. You can never know. And that's the real problem with not only the polygraph, but all these new forms of lie detection technology. And I think that's the lesson that can be learnt from the stories of Henry Wilkins, Joe Rappaport, John Larson, August Vollmer, Len Keeler, you know, from 100 years ago. That's the lesson that we should take through to today and into the future.
You talk about that lesson to take away. What would John Larson have said based on what he did have to write and say?
About today, about the current technology, I think he would have been frankly horrified that the polygraph is still being used. I think he would have urged more validation. I think he would have said, you know, we shouldn't be using these things in criminal cases until we're 100% sure they work. And I think maybe he would have come around to the view that you can never be 100% sure they work. So maybe we shouldn't be using them at all.
Fascinating. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about your extraordinary book, Tremors in the Blood, Murder, Obsession, and the Birth of the Lie Detector. For those that might want to take a look at your work, Do you have a website and you do any social media?
Yes, so I have a website. It's amitkatwala.co.uk. I'm also on Twitter. But you can find me, keep up with my work there as well. I also write for wired.com, so you can find my work on Wired as well.
Thank you so much, Amit Katwala, Tremors in the Blood, Murder, Obsession, and the Birth of the Lie Detector. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.
Thank you. Bye.